Mic is on. Okay. hey, everybody. Happy Friday. Thanks for dropping in to this spaces at the last minute. I'm really excited to introduce somebody that I've been working with for, it seems, a very long time. But it's really only been like 8 years, I guess. Jonathan Ross is with me. Maybe without further ado, maybe I'll just give Jonathan 30 seconds to introduce himself, and then we can just jump in with what the goals are of just this conversation. And I could ask a few questions, and then we can kick it off by letting everybody else jump into the space as well to ask questions. But Jonathan is one of the most interesting people in AI, and frankly, in many ways, one of the original true key innovators. And he'll tell you a lot about some of the stuff that he's done. But maybe I will just turn it over to him for a very quick intro, and then I can start with a few questions to tease out some of his background and things he would. Jonathan, you want to just say a few words?
Thanks, Shamath. Right, sorry, I was unable to hear you. So, what were you saying?
I said you're one of the OGs of this whole space. We've been working together now for 8 years. It's wonderful to have you on the space. But let's just start with a quick 30-second intro. Why don't you just tell people your background? Actually, I would say start with how you grew up, where you grew up, not graduating high school, the journey through Google and then to TPU. I just think but in a minute, if you can do it.
Okay, well, let's set a speed record on this one. My background, I dropped out of high school and somehow I ended up getting into NYU. I ended up in the applied math department, Courant Institute, and was, without it being in the PhD program, taking PhD courses. And then I dropped out of that because the company that I was working for went out of business and I had to pay my way forward. But I ended up at Google because some of the people at the Applied Math Institute there ended up at Google. They knew me, they brought me in, and I was doing ad stuff. And so I'd never done chips, and I ended up starting some interesting things at Google as a side project.
Well, let's jump into that. So you're working on ads, and I'm assuming ads optimization at Google, which is like a very important kind of group there. But what did you see, and how did you connect the dots between what you saw and the fact that Google should be building its own chips? Let's just start with
Yeah,
that.
so let's start off with a lesson for everyone. So I was in the New York Google office, and at the time, machine learning still wasn't really a thing. There was some sparse machine learning, nothing too fancy. The speech recognition team was in New York, and we were just having lunch together. It wasn't a business meeting or anything, and they were complaining that they just couldn't get enough compute. And I'm like, ooh, that sounds like an interesting problem. So I asked if they could give me a little bit of budget, and they did. And I started putting together a FPGA-based machine learning accelerator for them as a 20%. Every night I would go up to their space and I would start working with them. And then every day I would be in the normal ads part of things. And the lesson there was just keep your ears peeled because people will be complaining about their problems. And if you listen closely, they will tell you exactly what they need.
Okay, so you're working on this 20% project in FPGA land. And so take us through the leap from that to TPU.
So the architecture was almost identical. What happened was we ended up building a design for the FPGA. It ended up being what Google needed and ended up getting to pitch it to Jeff Dean. And Jeff Dean, smart engineer at Google, one of the two most senior, he's like, okay, we just got to build a chip. This is just going to scale like crazy. He had just given a presentation to the leadership team, and it was good news. Machine learning finally works. Bad news. We're going to have to spend $20 to $40 billion, and that's just for speech recognition. If we want to bring this into ads, if we want to bring this into knowledge or search, it's going to cost more. So we, in 1 year, went from getting the thumbs up from Jeff Dean to having a taped out chip that we ended up deploying in Google's data centers. So it was very fast.
Can you, Jonathan, can you just take a step back and just tell people in that iteration of AI before we get to today, what TensorFlow was and what it is today and what was unique about TPU that you guys designed to accelerate TensorFlow essentially?
So what we did was we realized that there was a particular math operation that had grown from being a very small portion of Google's workload to being a very large portion. That was matrix multiplication. And that was an observation by Jeff Dean. He just was looking through some logs and he realized one day matrix multiplication was over 50% of the compute that Google was doing. And alarm bells started going off because traditionally that was not a particularly significant operation. The chip that we built had dedicated matrix multiplication engines in it. So we built a chip around that. The thing is, it just was almost impossible to program. It was difficult to scale up, but it was very fast. And so we used a lot of glue and duct tape to get that thing into production. But it ended up being the engine for a lot of, I think within 1 year of being deployed, it was more than 50% of all of Google's compute.
That was a huge success. And how I learned about you in part was, Sundar in a earnings release, my gosh, this would have been in 2017, maybe, mentioned TPU and my ears perked up. And I thought, wait a minute, I had no idea that Google would be, spinning its own custom silicon. And that's when I sort of set out to meet you and found a way to meet you through Sunny Modern.
Yeah.
You were there, obviously TPU was working. I'm sure you were very valued. That's a very special place for very talented engineers. Why do you leave a place like that in that moment?
Well, at this point, it became very clear that there were going to be the haves and the have-nots when it came to AI compute. And I was getting these unsolicited requests from the other hyperscalers to come and build chips for them. And their pitch was typically, this is Google, this is China, those two are going to have all the compute. And we have to make sure that others have compute as well. And I'm like, geez, like going and building this for one other hyperscaler wasn't really going to solve that problem. It was just going to make it equally bad. I needed to go out, build a chip, make it available to everyone. And the real mission there was I was getting worried that if a small set of people was going to be setting all of the roadmap for AI, that we were at risk of, being captured fundamentally, like from a point of view of a small group of people just setting the direction for humanity. So we started Grok to make sure that human agency was preserved in the age of AI.
So do you want to tell folks what the original idea of the first Grok chip was and what it is today?
All right. So let's geek out.
Versus what it
is
today?
It's very similar, but there were some things that we discovered along the way. The thing that was most similar was we realized that GPUs were nearly impossible to program. And if we had to manually program the chip that we were building, like GPUs and TPUs are programmed, there was no way to scale. It was a double-sided market. In fact, you brought up TensorFlow earlier. When we developed TensorFlow at Google, we had to write what are called kernels, which are these low-level assembly routines for GPUs. Otherwise, we wouldn't have been relevant. So that meant that we were writing code for chips that we weren't building in order to make TensorFlow relevant. Looking at that, we realized when we started Grok, we were going to have to approach software very differently. What we did was we spent the first 6 months working on the compiler. And we spent the first 6 months in Social Capital. We were in your incubator. And you remember all those events we would have where we would demo stuff. And we were like, so we were just on a tear. But as soon as we moved into our own space, we forbid whiteboards because people kept trying to draw pictures of chips. And it was backwards. When you're building an amazing car or driving experience, you don't start with the engine. You start with the driver experience. That was the first thing. The second thing was we realized, based on experience where people were like, for example, the AlphaGo competition where Google beat the world's best player in Go, we realized that the scale of compute for inference was going to be as large or larger than for training. And so we built this chip, we call it an LPU or language processing unit, specifically for very large scale inference. What we never expected was that large language models would be the thing that would be running on them. We knew it would be big inference. We knew it would be big models. We never thought language.
So this is one of these lucky breaks that happen from time to time. But talk about why you were building the emergence of transformers and then, you know, what OpenAI has done. And just now bring folks and level set them to where is the world today when we talk about, frankly, like these not just large language models, but all these advanced forms of neural networks. Because initially, you know, for years, we were really focused on ResNet and doing a lot of CNNs and stuff like that. And now, you know, you're largely exclusively doubling down on LLMs. But maybe catch folks that aren't as knowledgeable up to speed on that path.
Yeah, the biggest difference with generative AI to AI, and that's really where we find ourselves, is that in generative AI, there's a sequential nature to it. For example, you can't predict the 100th token or word until you've predicted the 99th token or word. It's like playing chess. When you're playing chess, you have about 30 moves you can make, and which move you make determines which move can come next. When you are using a large language model, it's exactly the same, except instead of 30 moves, it's 32,000 moves. That's how many different tokens there are to choose from. And if I choose a token such as, if I start saying, the president of Botswana is, but if I don't know who the president of Botswana is, I've checkmated myself. I'm now committed to giving that answer. That's where, just like chess, you have to think sequentially. What tokens am I going to put out there and what is going to come next? And you have to be strategic. And that is not something that the existing hardware is very good at. The existing hardware is great at doing a whole bunch of things in parallel that don't depend on each other. LPUs are designed specifically to be very good at going fast at sequential things.
So this is a really important point. People use a lot of different metrics to talk about AI, right? You know, NVIDIA will point to the number of cores as an example. You know, sometimes we'll talk about tokens per second as something that, you know, other folks care about. Batch size is another thing. The latency is another thing. Can you give folks sort of a rank order in this generative LLM world? What matters the most and why?
What matters is quality and speed. Quality, because if the model isn't producing something intelligible, if it's gibberish, no one's going to care, no one's going to use it. But speed matters, because if we went back in time and you were getting search results that took 3 seconds, you wouldn't use it. You're so used to that speed. In fact, every 100 milliseconds of latency impacts conversion rates by about 8%. That's on desktop. On mobile, it's over 30%. We're kind of seeing ourselves, and you might like this analogy, Shamath, we're kind of seeing ourselves in the MySpace era of generative AI, because people are actually right, looking at accounts signed up and not really the engagement. And that's because they're so slow. When you start getting speed, the usage spikes. I'm actually watching, we have a demo on our website running on our LPUs. It's not a product. We don't have all the things that you need for it to be a product. And we're watching usage grow day by day. We've got 3 times as many people using us today as were using us yesterday, just because of the speed.
So explain to folks, like, you know, what batch size is, what tokens per second mean, and what you would look at if you were just an independent, unvested third party on how to measure speed and quality.
Yeah, the metrics are new. I would start with time to first token, and then I would start with, then I would look at output rate, or how many tokens per second. If you're doing speech, okay, what you care about is time to first sentence, because you can't generate the audio for a sentence until you have the entire sentence, because the tone starts to go down as you speak. But that time to first token is what you're waiting for. It's sort of like an awkward pause. And then that rate of tokens out, you can't read it. It's too distracting until you get the whole thing. So how quickly can you output that? In fact, I could give you a demo if you're interested.
Actually, okay, yeah. If you want to do a demo, let's do it. Let's see if the demo gods are with us here. So tell us what you're going to demo before you, as you're setting it up or as it's starting.
Okay.
What is this that we're
So about doing? 2 weeks ago, we opened up our API to a select set of users who reached out to us and asked for
users or third-party developers.
So people who are writing code, people who are developing their own AI systems. And we're picking some of the best of the best. And last Thursday, we got this reach out from a company called VAPI, VAPI. They already had something. It was using OpenAI's LLMs. And we gave them access. And within 3 hours, they had the following working. And what I'm going to show you is they're using the large language model provided by Meta, Llama 2 70 billion, running on our hardware. And then they use text-to-speech and speech-to-text from some others. But the fact that we can process the query so quickly and produce an output so quickly is what's going to make this a very different experience.
Right. So as we listen to this, what are we judging here? We're judging
speed.
What?
The only thing is the speed. The content is not what you're judging. It's just, is this an interactive experience?
Okay.
All right. Here we go.
I'm Grok. You can talk to me like I'm a person. How can I help you today?
Hi, can you tell me what Grok builds?
Sure thing. Grok is an AI-centric software platform designed for running real-time AI solutions at scale, particularly optimized for language-based AI applications. Would you like to know more about Grok's LPU inference engine?
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, before we get there, can you just tell me how many people work at Grok?
Sure thing. Grok has 180 employees, mostly in North America. Would you like to know more about the leadership team?
Yes, please.
Sure thing. The LPU inference engine, standing for language processing
unit. You were telling me about the leadership team. Ignoring the CEO, can you tell me who else works at Grok on the leadership team?
Sure thing. Grok's leadership team consists of its CEO, Jonathan Ross, who created Google's AI processor, the TPU, as well as Jim Miller, who prior to joining Grok, led the design of all compute hardware for AWS, Andy Cunningham, Grok's fractional CMO, who led marketing for the launch of the Macintosh computer in 1984, Aileen Black, who prior to Grok built and led public sector teams for Google Cloud Platform.
All that's super cool, but the thing that I'd really like to know is, why does latency matter for the user experience in generative AI?
That's a great question. Latency is critical for generative AI because it directly impacts the user experience. With lower latency, users can interact with the AI in real time, allowing for a more seamless and responsive experience. This is particularly important in applications like chatbot.
All right.
So, Jonathan, explain. So basically, that's something that scraped your website, basically, right?
Actually, yeah. And we just took a little bit of text from our marketing material, threw it in the system prompt, and all of a sudden it was an expert on Grok.
Right. So the idea is that this has to do your speech to text, then it's got to process it, then it's got to get context, then it's got to go and fetch the right answer. It has to be correct and accurate, and then you have to come back and translate it and then output in her voice, and you need to do it in how, and what is the round trip time and all of that, in the hundreds of milliseconds?
Yeah, it has to be hundreds of milliseconds. If it's over 500 milliseconds, it's completely unusable. We're targeting closer to 150 milliseconds. But also keep in mind, we're doing a round trip to Washington State, which is about 900 miles away from where I am. And even with that additional latency, we're able to get that speed.
Tell us about, everybody talks about NVIDIA. First, let's start with Steel Manning. Why NVIDIA is so good? Okay,
yeah.
I think it's important. And explain to folks, maybe, is CUDA good or bad? Mm. Like in an objective sense, and then let's double click on some of the other folks.
So CUDA is the best we've had. AMD has been building GPUs that are faster than NVIDIA for at least the last 5 or 6 years. The problem is, if you build a GPU and it's 30% faster, the physical hardware, but the software makes it 30% slower, then it's slower. It really doesn't matter how fast the hardware is. Now, over time, you can improve that software performance, but it takes so long that by the time you get there, it's irrelevant. What you're seeing with NVIDIA is they have so many developers on their platform that, like I was saying, when we did TensorFlow at Google, we had to write the kernels for them. They've almost got this double-sided market where people are building CUDA kernels for NVIDIA GPUs. When a new model comes out, it works on NVIDIA. Now, when Llama 2 came out, it had official support for AMD's GPUs. We actually got it running on our LPUs faster than it actually worked on AMD's GPUs because we've gotten rid of those kernels. In fact, the demo that I was just doing, that was running on 640 LPUs. And that's very different than the way that you do this with GPUs. Normally you'll have 8. And the way to think about it is with a GPU, it's almost like you have to have 1 million square feet of assembly line space, and you only have 100,000 square feet. So you have to set up the first 1/10 of the assembly line, run a bunch of cars through, tear it down, then run it through, set it up, run the cars through again, tear it down. If you were building cars by tearing down the factory over and over again and setting it up again, it would take forever. That's what it's like with a GPU with external memory. With LPUs, we've designed our own networking, we've designed our own compiler, everything. So we actually just have 640 chips, so everything fits in the memory of the chips. You're not using external memory, and that's why it's so fast.
For the folks that are entrepreneurs building apps for this next gen AI landscape, why is that important to understand? So meaning, let's just say like they're just trying to get access to models. They're probably signed up for an enterprise account on OpenAI. Maybe they're signed up for an account on Amazon. What are the limitations that they need to understand versus where the market will be in a year or 2 years?
Yeah, I was chatting with one of the VPs at one of the companies building their own proprietary models, and he made this very interesting comment, which is he could barely keep up with the internal development, but he couldn't come close to keeping up with the open source development. Open source has been moving so quickly that a lot of the innovation is now coming from there. And we're about to see open source models that outperform the proprietary models. In fact, just this week, Meta released Llama 270 billion for code. And that is a GPT-4 equivalent across the board on code, and it's free. So the only question you have is where are you going to run these models? Because all of them are being given away for free. And now it's going to be about the speed because the quality is being given away.
Okay, so let's double click on that. So if we're a developer and, we go and we raise a seed round or a series A, that money is precious. Mm-hmm. What are our choices today to get access to super fast, super cheap compute? And just if you can numerically help us understand those costs, like how do CEOs and founders and entrepreneurs here make good trade-offs about where they should be building these apps?
Yeah. That's a great question. I mean, obviously, I'm going to say you should be doing this with Grok because we do this faster and we do it cheaper. But what you're going to see is there are a lot of companies that are building token as a service businesses. And what they're doing is they're charging a price that is largely venture capital subsidized for access to that hardware. And they offer fine tuning services. And those fine tuning services are the sort of sticky, get you stuck moat where you fine tune on them and then you have to run the model with them. What you want to do is you want to start watching these new foundation models that keep coming out, because what we keep seeing is people fine tune their model, they get it working, and then a new foundation model comes out that's even better and they have to refine tune and it takes forever. So what you want to look for are those who are running the largest, most powerful open source models at the cost that is affordable for your application. One thing that we're seeing a lot of people make a mistake on is they're trying to use smaller models. And that would be great for us because we run smaller models even faster. But it's a mistake because you start to get more hallucinations. The larger the model, like I'll give you an example. I was in Washington, D.C. last week. We were going to an event. All of us in the car just had this instinct that we were in the wrong place. It just wasn't, it didn't seem like the part of town where this event would be. But we just followed the instructions of the GPS. And of course, it was the wrong place. Why did we all realize it was the wrong place? Because we had such experience, we were able to realize that something was off. The larger the model, the more capable it is of determining that there's going to be a hallucination and avoiding it. So even if you're doing something very specific, you should be looking for the place where you can run the largest models at the lowest cost, where you get speed.
Because then that's your trade-off, speed and quality, so that you maintain quality while you maximize speed. That's effectively what
you're saying. Yes, and you can also turn speed into quality. Are you familiar with reflection?
No, tell us what that is.
Well, one way to think about these large language models, ask them to do a task, ask them to write some code, ask them to write a document, and then look at the output and notice how good it is when you consider the fact that the large language model didn't have access to a backspace or a delete key. It made no mistakes. If a human being did that, right, we would be shocked. These models are better than most of us realize, and we're sort of handicapping them by saying, just give me your stream of consciousness output, and then we're going to use that. Reflection is saying, okay, I got this output. What are five ways that this answer could be better? Great, apply those to your answer. And very often I will do a demo where I'll take Llama 2 70 billion, which isn't even GPT 3.5 quality, and I will do about 6 iterations on very standard templated questions that don't respond to what's coming out. Just like start with an outline, give me 5 ways to improve it. And after those 6 iterations or reflections, people generally say, wow, that is much better than GPT-4 in terms of quality. And so the rule of thumb is 3 reflections are about a model generation of quality improvement. But you need latency for that.
Can you actually just maybe close this chapter on open source versus closed source models for us? Can you help us understand if we're making a design decision? I think what I heard you say is take the raw, non-fine-tuned, largest open source model possible, because that's the least business risk. That's how I interpret it. It's like you're saying to me, Chamath, if you're going to build a product, build it on Llama 70B, because whatever happens is just rip and replace, versus maybe Mistral, which is a fine tune of Llama, which you still have to deal with the refine tune, so you could be delayed, versus the GPT model from OpenAI, which is closed. Is that the way that I should interpret what you're saying?
Yeah, very close. I would say it's sort of like choosing your flavor of Linux. Do you want to use Ubuntu? Do you want to use Red Hat? Or do you want to take the mainline version of Linux and start customizing it? At some point, whichever versions of Linux you're using, they're going to be better than you could possibly do on your own. And if you're modifying your own version of Linux, you don't get to stay up to date with these better mainline, or these better flavors of Linux. Now, Mistral is actually, they are training some of their own models. They do fine tune some things as well. I would consider them one of the main lines, along with Llama from Meta, but you want to stick with those.
And so what about Google's models?
Well, the
Bard, Gemini, where do they stand in the realm of the usable if we're trying to build a business?
Those are great models. They're just proprietary, and they're not really that much better than the open source models. So the question is, what value are you getting by going proprietary? In fact, if you want, you can run Llama, you can run Mistral on GCP. You don't have to use their proprietary model.
Right. And now tell us as well, what is the cost of actually building an app today for scale and success and speed? Is it realistically doable on either Amazon or GCP or Azure or OpenAI? Are any of those four able to give enough of a substrate so that, somebody like we can go build the Facebook from, to replace the MySpace, so to speak?
It's not as binary as can you or can't you. It's what can you do today. Right now, it's still too expensive for you to build really long tail applications. So what we're seeing people do is build applications where people are willing to sign up and pay, hundreds of dollars per month. What will enable you to go after that really long tail of customers where you're doing something either for free and you've got a different monetization strategy, or where you're charging a de minimis amount per month, is much cheaper access to this. Now, one of the main expenses here is the GPU. GPUs, even if they weren't being marked up so much, are very expensive because of a technology known as HBM, which is the type of memory that a GPU uses, and it's very limited. Thanks to that, if you want to deploy something on one of these services, you're looking at spending $1 to $10 per megatoken or million tokens of input or output. And that's pretty expensive. What we want to do is we want to drive that cost down 10x, because if we drive the cost down 10x, there are things that you can do that were impossible before, and we will make more money because of that, because there will be more applications. This is known in economics as Jevons paradox. And if you look at the last 50 to 60 years of compute, every decade, like clockwork, compute has gotten 1,000 times cheaper. People have spent 100, they bought 100,000 times as much compute, and so they've spent 100 times as much.
That's a great soundbite, actually. I'm going to open this up for questions, but so I'm going to ask a question, but if you guys can just raise your hand, and then Ali will make sure. What about sort of the costs of energy on top of everything else? And so the ability for like the large hyperscalers to get access to the energy that it takes versus some of these smaller upstarts like Together AI or other folks. How do you think about just like the total cost? What will dominate? Who's in a position to compete, I guess? Oh, you're on mute. Can't hear you. No, hold on, Jonathan. 1 second.
Okay, can you hear me now?
Yeah, you're
back. Yeah, apologies for that. So one of the ways to think about this, and a friend of ours put it this way, he said, you are the SpaceX of large language model services, which is there are people who are renting GPUs by the hour and running something on top of that. And when they do that, it's very hard to be competitive price-wise. When you own your own hardware, you pay it off, and then you can keep using it from that point forward. So the AWSs, the Googles, and these folks are deploying their own hardware, and that gives them a fundamental advantage over a lot of the startups in this space who are renting those GPUs. Grok is much more like one of them in the sense that we are deploying our own hardware, but it's almost as if we were a competitor to SpaceX where our rocket cost about one third as much and we used about one third the rocket fuel. And so that gives you a pretty fundamental advantage in terms of bringing the cost down.
Let me open it up to some questions because there's a ton of folks that want to ask questions. I'll start with Joe. Joe, go ahead.
Yeah, thanks, Jamal. Hey, thanks, Jonathan. I work for your former employer, so thank you. I sell a lot of what you created.
Thanks.
I actually want to get your perspective on gaming out the future of NVIDIA. How do they play the next decade? Because working at a hyperscale cloud company, I see a collision course coming where NVIDIA no longer wants to just supply the chips. They actually want to engage customers directly. They're building out go-to-market sales teams to do that exactly. They're getting a lot of traction with their BioNeMo drug discovery platform. So at what point, you know, do the hyperscalers and NVIDIA get into a collision course? And this, in general, where do you see competition for NVIDIA over the next decade?
Thanks, Joe. That's a great question. I think it's already happening. NVIDIA is already building their own cloud and trying to do it in a fairly sneaky way where, oh, it's not really our cloud, but it is. And NVIDIA has a history of forward integrating. What NVIDIA has done that has given them another advantage over, say, AMD or Intel is, you know, they build the chips and then they realize, oh, if I build the system and put the chips in it, I can reduce the total margin stacking and I can have an advantage over everyone else. And the next logical step in that is the data center. And then, of course, hosting the LLMs themselves. And so they are attempting to do the entire stack themselves. And there was this really frustrated post made, I think, by Gigabyte or one of their customers who was buying GPUs and building cards. And they're like, NVIDIA has just made it impossible for us to do business. We're going to exit the GPU card business. And that was 70% of their revenue. So you're exactly right. NVIDIA is going to keep doing this, and they're just going to keep forward integrating further and further and further until they are their own hyperscaler.
So then that does put them on a total collision course with the hyperscalers themselves. Now, but the reverse is also true, right? Like Amazon has spun their own silicon in, what is it called?
Inferentia and Trainium.
Yeah, exactly. And obviously Google has TPU and whatever derivatives they've built since then. And I think Meta said in their quarterly update yesterday that they're spinning their own inference silicon. So it just seems like everybody's going to compete with everybody.
That's true. But I would point out one thing here, which is when we started the TPU at Google, that was actually one of three efforts started to do AI chips at Google. And only one of them, the TPU, was actually faster than a GPU by the time that it launched. If you look at all of these other attempts to build accelerators, they have been unsuccessful. They're either very slow, the software doesn't work. It has not been successful at any of these other hyperscalers building it for themselves. If you look at NVIDIA, they have successfully forward integrated over and over again. So if I was going to bet on the hyperscalers or NVIDIA, I would probably bet on NVIDIA. What you need is an alternative to NVIDIA that can actually stand up toe-to-toe to them, or even better, have an advantage over them.
I have a question, but I just want to remind people to just raise their hand and get in the line, and Ali will manage this. Talk about Tesla for a second. So, you know, in many ways, Tesla's edge silicon is doing incredible inference today, right? And, you know, they've probably pushed the boundaries on the quality of their CNNs and the quality of their learning and inference. So curious about their silicon and what would happen if they, you know, open source that or, you know, put it into a cloud that was available to others.
Well, others have open sourced their silicon and it was met with crickets. In fact, NVIDIA open sourced their, I believe, Tegra line. I don't remember which line it was exactly. And it got zero traction. Part of the reason is, it's not about the silicon, it's about all that software. And at this point, Tesla has acknowledged that they have a couple of applications that they've developed working on it, but their software is nowhere near as advanced as even AMD's, let alone NVIDIA's. And you just have to have the software working or you've got no product in this space.
Are you worried that the industry, if it doesn't find these NVIDIA alternatives, like, why have people been so supportive of CUDA? Like, do they not see the risk that, you know, implementing it through this interface actually creates lock-in to one hardware vendor, which I think we've learned in history is never a good end solution?
People see the risk. I often meet with potential customers or prospects, and one of the requirements for that meeting is that if anyone were ever to find out about it, they will disavow that we ever met. The feedback that I get is there are actually some companies now that are starting and trying to use only alternatives to NVIDIA because their concern is if they were to buy NVIDIA GPUs, which you have to pay for in advance, and they bought anything from anyone else, they would never get delivery of those NVIDIA GPUs. So they'd be out the money, but they would never get them. There is fear. There is fear at the C levels at the hyperscalers for NVIDIA. And no one really believes that there's an alternative. So you just have to keep building it, knowing that people are not going to lean forward because they're afraid.
I have a question, but I'll save it. But Monkey, you go next, and then I'll ask my follow-up.
Hey, Chamath. Hey, Jonathan. Love this talk. I have two questions. One, how do you think the chip market for AI is going to work out? How do accelerator chip markets play out in the long run in like previous iterations? And that, why do you think like Grok has this like strategic advantage here? Like, what's the business strategy from what you can share? Like, that would be interesting for me. I think others might find that interesting too. And the second question would be like, if it's not too off topic, who do you think the big winners in AI are going to be? Not specifically like in chips, like in general.
One second, Jonathan's going to come back on. Hold on one sec, guys. I think there's a, we have to re-turn him on every time we ask a question. Sorry about that. It just takes a sec. As soon as we know, you're not back. Hold on. Huh? What's that? Oh, well, yeah. I mean, I guess I can give you my version of the answer while Jonathan gets back on. I think that there are these, there's going to be a sort of a bimodal distribution within AI. I think that Jonathan is, he made a really important point about the quality of these open source models. I completely agree with him. I think that the large companies who are open sourcing these models have an enormous economic incentive to effectively scorch the earth, so to speak. So to try to create the most open, cheap, widely available, and most powerful models possible. And frankly, what that means is that's all about Meta, Mistral, and maybe there are a couple of others. At the if you are closed, I think that you are generally going to be in trouble. That's the first comment. The second comment is, I'll give you his, he used the MySpace analogy. When we were building Facebook, one of the things that we realized was speed was the critical differentiator in our growth. And, you know, we had sometimes, you know, page load times in a cold cache that were like 1500 milliseconds, which is like a second and a half. And, you know, we knew the same thing that Jonathan knew, which is that we needed to have, you know, page load times that were in the 200 millisecond kind of range. And the minute we did that, our growth went, you know, even more nuclear. And so the companies that can deliver essentially millisecond latency as cheaply as possible will also be the winners. So those are the two. Those are the two big groups. Okay, Jonathan's back. Go ahead. You give your answer.
I just had to turn it off and turn it on again. All right. So the question was really, how is this chip space going to evolve? How is that going to happen? Going back to the forward integration point, I think what we've learned is you can't sell a chip into this space. There's just too much. It's too complex. You need your own networking. You need your own software stack, compiler stack. You need everything. Even AMD isn't being trusted right now. And there's some very public comments about this because even though they can build a GPU, even though they can put it in a system, they don't have the software. They don't have all the rest of the stack. And that gap is only going to widen over time. So anyone who's building a chip is building the wrong thing. Now, the way that I see it evolving is anyone who can build the entire stack top to bottom has a shot. And anyone who can't, I think, is going to struggle. So what you're going to see is instead of chip companies challenging NVIDIA, you're going to see people offering services where they deploy the whole thing themselves end to end.
A ton of cloud vendors competing, and the ones that have their own proprietary hardware have a better Correct. Shot than those that
That's don't. Exactly right.
Jonathan, two questions. One is there was a survey. And there seems to be these increasing frequency of third-party surveys around speed and quality. And there was one that just came out a couple of days ago. I think you tweeted it, then I tweeted it. But can you tell us who this third party is and what are they measuring and why should folks maybe pay attention to it? Forget about who won or lost, but just give us the parameters of why that's important.
Yeah, so I think it was called Artificial Analysis, and it was a recent third-party benchmark. And also Anyscale, who provides token as a service, also did a benchmark. And what all of them are measuring is very different than what has been measured before because they're measuring the customer experience. When you look at something like MLPerf, which is the benchmark that everyone's using in the industry, it has a bunch of terms in it that have nothing to do with what the customers are asking about. It doesn't even have the models people are using. It has like GPT-J, which is a model no one talks about. Artificial analysis in any scale we're benchmarking is on Llama 270 billion, how long do you have to wait for the first token while a system is under load? And then how quickly do you get those out?
Jonathan, we just lost you. Hold on, guys, one sec. It's a bit of a cliffhanger. What is he going to say? It's great to see that one of the smartest people in the world's solution to this is also turn his phone off and turn it back on. No, I feel smarter. Let's give it a few seconds and see if he can reset it. Sorry about that, guys. It is not us. Is he there? Is he back? I see him on the. Oh, there he is. Hello. Okay.
That's awesome. Which is where you hit it really hard. Those both work great.
Yeah. Exactly.
Okay. All right. Speaking of which, dependability of services is actually a thing that matters. And one of the things that this new one is measuring, this artificial analysis company, is they're actually checking whether or not you're up. And one of the problems that a lot of these services have today, I was told by a customer that's using the largest large language model provider right now, that they have days where they're only up 90% of the day. You just can't build a business on that. So one of the other things they're measuring is that. And you're going to start seeing a requirement as people depend on these services for it to be up much right. more.
Can you also walk people through, this is another thing that a lot of people would probably maybe interested to understand, is the process technology behind NVIDIA and frankly behind Grok, and sometimes why it's so expensive to make an H100. Forget the markups, but you know, part of what is so expensive about this is their process technology is what, 2 or 3 nanometer. You know, you guys are at 14, and the implications of that when we think about, you know, scaling this to thousands and thousands and thousands of racks and systems.
Well, and
you know, billions
and availability of supply. So one of the really important things, up until recently, you didn't have to really improve your architecture. You'd have one successful architecture, and that was it. You just let the fabs get better and better and better. I think AMD did an analysis and they found something ridiculous, like only 18% of the improvement that they had over 20 years was actually architectural. The rest of it was just letting the fabs get better. That's crazy. So if you want to build a modern GPU, you build it on what's called 4 nanometer or 3 nanometer. It's incredibly expensive. It costs tens of billions of dollars to build these fabs to do it. And there's only a couple of geographies in the world that do this. Grok is actually built on 14 nanometer silicon. That's so many generations behind that it's considered almost a legacy technology. And yet, if you go to chat.grok.com, Grok with a Q, try us out and see how fast we are versus anything else you've ever tried. It's very, very fast, but it's on 14 nanometer. And as for supply, oftentimes you're building this with HBM, which is a memory technology that's built by Samsung and SK Hynix. And there's very limited supply for this. So actually, I just saw a spike in traffic on our website. So some of your users just tried it, or some of your listeners. But you'll notice it's incredibly speedy. And that's on an old technology. By the end of next year, we expect to have about 20 times as much capacity deployed as OpenAI will have at that point, because we are supply unconstrained. We're using this older technology. There isn't a limit in terms of our ability to spin up more capacity. And that is going to be crucial, because it's not just going to be how expensive or what the quality is or how fast. It's also, do you even have it?
Right. Question from Artificial Analysis. I guess they heard we were talking about them. Their ears were burning. They're here. Go ahead.
I did. Joined at the right time. And thanks for the shout out. I'm interested. You mentioned attempts to bring chips to market or even internally by other large, well-funded hyperscalers haven't been successful. I'm interested what Grok's, I guess, done differently and how much has it been innovating in engineering versus taking a different perspective from an organization.
Yeah, when you look at most of the other alternatives out there, there's a very clever idea. For example, let's just build one really big chip, or let's take a bunch of chips and stick them together on some sort of really clever packaging or something like that. But there hasn't been an architectural redesign. Those may be an advantage. And in the chip industry, typically if you had a 20 or 30% advantage, that led to you being the winner. But you have to have the software working on you. So the first thing that we did at Grok was we got the software working. Then we were able to worry about the performance and what else we were able to do. But in terms of architecture, we did everything different from the bottom up. It's going to get a bit technical, but we did something where we made a deterministic and synchronous chip. Or another way to put it, it's sort of like we enabled calendar scheduling for the chip. When you're using a GPU or CPU, there's a bunch of queues, and data gets stuck in that queue and has to wait until there's availability of resources to process it. In our chips, even when we're running on 640 different chips, everything is scheduled in advance to the clock cycle. It'd be as if you had 640 people working on a project, and everyone handed over their task to the next person at exactly the right time. And that's a totally different paradigm. We had to create our own networking to make that work. We had to create our own chips, our own compiler, our own system software to make all of that work. It's a huge lift.
That must also be is that the limiting factor in scale too, is just getting that scheduler to be able to scale across multiple chips and racks and systems? Like, if you have a, you know, a Facebook-esque, Google-esque data center running one task or one app, is there a limit to that scheduling?
No, actually, the scheduling is what allows us to bring so many chips together. Typically, a GPU or with a GPU solution, you have about 8 GPUs when you're doing inference, because the speed at which you have to give an answer is you have to be very fast. And if you're not scheduling, then you're losing a lot of that time waiting for stuff to show up. It's actually the scheduling that allows us to scale. We have plans to start running that model, which is currently running on 640 chips. We're planning to start moving that up to 2,560 by the end of this year, because we're actually going to be much faster and lower cost by scaling up to that.
What is the upper bound for, again, take you off the table for a second, the best in class tokens per second, what is it today? And then just tell us where you're at, and then tell us what your goal, whatever you're comfortable telling us, for like a, you know, 6 months from now or a year from now, and how do you get there?
Well, since we have the artificial analysis folks on, I think it would be best to let them say how fast they've actually seen.
Yeah. Artificial analysis. Tell us like what is good right now. And then tell us sort of what people are telling you in terms of what will be good maybe in 6 months, if you don't mind putting you on the spot.
Sure.
Sorry.
Sure. No. So prior to adding Grok, the record we had was 120 tokens per second. And then when we added Grok and we measured it, it's one of those see it to believe it things. And we saw 240 tokens per second. So we had to adjust the axis on our graph. And I think in terms of where it will go, I think there's two ways in which we'll see optimizations. One is from the software perspective, so people making changes to models, et cetera. And then the other is from the hardware perspective. I think my general hypothesis is that there's a limited scope in terms of software. There's only so many things that you can do to a model of a certain size, but there's essentially greater potential in hardware. So I think that's where we'll see changes in the next 6 months.
Well, here, let's do a fun exercise. Artificial analysis. I'm asking you, put you on the spot, guess where you think best-in-class tokens per second will be in 6 months. And then, Jonathan, I want you to tell us what you're trying to achieve, but then tell us how you think you can do it.
I love it.
And okay, go ahead. Artificial analysis. What do you think the best in class is going to be in 6 months?
We're for a similar size model as Llama 70B, we're at 240 now. I'd have to say you know, I'd hope for 350. I mean, thinking about the use cases that it enables would be amazing.
Okay. All right. So earlier this year, we were showing off 330 tokens per second. The reason that you don't see that on our website right now is we made a bunch of changes to be able to handle a lot of users in parallel. That's why you can go to our website. We made number one on Hacker News, and the site purred like a kitten. We just got a big blow up thanks to you guys on Reddit, and we're purring like a kitten. But that's about as low as it can go. By the end of the year, we do expect for it to grow by more than a multiple. And I'm not going to say exactly what, because I want to leave some surprises. But all of that is without doing a lot of the enhancements that you're seeing. One of the interesting bits of sort of concern that we got from a potential customer, they said, yeah, you guys are just running the model. You're not doing these things like speculative decode or Eagle or all these, or whatever they're called, all these other tricks that people are using to get their performance up. That's got to be sort of hard to port to your hardware. And we're like, but we're faster now and we haven't done those. Those are all little bonuses that we're going to get. So when I say that we're going to get a multiple, that multiple is before doing all that stuff. And there will be an order of magnitude change at some point. And I'll leave it at that.
Yeah, this may be a good comment, a point to make this comment. I was having lunch with Adam D'Angelo, who one of my really good friends, I've worked with him since Facebook. He's the CEO of Quora, also the CEO of Poe. But he said something to me which was very powerful. He's like, Chamath, the way that you have to think about this landscape and why this entire move to AI is so transformational is the following. You know, the models are increasing at a rate where you can expect, let's just call, you know, a 2 to 5x quality improvement in the quality of these models over the next year. But at the same time, you're going to have the underlying hardware increase by, let's just call it, you know, 5 to 10x. And then you have CapEx that will be another 10x multiplier, right? Because you'll just buy so much more of it. And when you multiply those things together, you're talking about a multi-100xing, Jonathan, back to your economics comment before, just in terms of what the art of the possible is in less than a year. And then even if you assume a 50% decay, then you have to multiply that again by basically almost 100. So now you're talking about 1,000xing in 2 years. And so the question that I keep asking myself every day, and I'm so consumed with it because it's a little overwhelming, what isn't possible when you 1,000x what we know today? And I have very few answers. And so I'm a little bit struggling with actually where to start in terms of looking at these end user applications and trying to figure out a logical starting point, because you know, you're taking two of these elements and ramming the cost. As you said, well, these open source guys are taking that third element and ramming down, you know, the price expectations while ramping up quality and parameter size. It's really scary in a very healthy way, but it's very scary, very exciting what's possible.
The way that I look at this is people keep saying things like this is just the next internet or just the next mobile. And my response to that is those are information age technologies where you take a piece of data and you with very high fidelity distribute it to as many people as you can. Same thing as the printing press, just better. This is not an information age technology. We're talking about these models being creative. They can actually create things that didn't exist before. And that is new. We don't have the intuition for it. I've already seen some small customers building things that I have never even seen in a science fiction movie. Our intuition isn't there yet. As people get more access, as this becomes more widely deployed, this is going to be an exciting ride.
Unless there are any more questions, I think that's a really positive and beautiful note to end this on. I'm going to ask Ali to clean up the audio, and then I think, you know, we'll, I think we should publish this to everybody. Jonathan, That was incredibly informative.
Well, thank you very much.
And excellent. And exciting. And I say this not as an investor. I really just say it as a person just in the general industry. It's amazing when people are building cool shit. It's really cool.
Thank you very much. And as a reminder, I think, Shamath, you put over 90% of our seed and A round together. So you saw the importance of this pretty early on.
Yeah, often wrong, never in doubt. but I'm really wishing you guys the best. And I really appreciate you explaining all of this. Because I think, again, this is a point in time where we all hear the buzzwords or the acronyms. And it's just so important. It's worth learning because it really is a modern economic upheaval. And so you have to start somewhere, start slowly, but people should learn because the things that will be created will be shocking. And I think everybody can be on the ground floor, you know? And guys like you, super, super technical people, are going to abstract it so that, you know, guys like me who can maybe write a product in prose into a Word doc will spit out the next Facebook. That's what's probable in the next 15 years, you know? And that's really crazy.
Absolutely.
Well, thank you very much for that. And all of you folks that took the time to listen, I really appreciate that you did that. We'll clean this up and publish it. And for those that are interested in office hours, that'll be next week. And we keep marching and fighting the good fight.
Awesome.
Thanks, everybody. Jonathan, thank you very, very much.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
Bye.
Thank you. See you.